On air, online, or on the go, you're listening to Radio 91. 91.1 KRCB FM Windsor and 90.9 KQ215 CQ Santa Rosa. Here's throughout the Bay Area on Comcast Channel 961. It's 8 p.m. Stay with us. Outbeat Radio is next.
Welcome to Outbeat Radio on KRCB Windsor Santa Rosa, a program that focuses on issues by, for, and or about members of the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender communities. You can hear Outbeat Radio every Sunday night at 8 p.m.
This is Living Proof, and we're your hosts. I'm Dr. Diana Grayer, and next to me is my co-host and wife, Sheridan Gold. This is our Freedom Show in honor of July 4th, and tonight's guest is demonstrating her kind of freedom. We have Mandy Camille. I hope you didn't mind me saying your last name. I mean, your middle name. Haworth. Haworth in the house. Mandy is the first transgender correctional officer at San Quentin Prison.
Mm-hmm.
And she is here to share her story. And we want to welcome Mandy. Hi, Mandy.
Hello, thank you.
And I met you first at Kaya Kramer's Queer Life Show, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I had such a wonderful time with Kaya. She is the bomb. Hello,
yeah, she's
Kaya.
She's amazing.
Yes. And you were like her supporting cast with Key. You both were so welcoming to me. So
yeah, thank you.
I just say I needed to have you on this show, our Living Proof show. So welcome, welcome, welcome.
Yeah, thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah, we're really happy to have you here, Mandy. And I know that I'm speaking for everyone who's listening, but we're really looking forward to hearing your story.
Yeah, me
tonight.
Too.
Yeah. But first, here's news and events with Outbeat member and our engineer, Greg Maralia.
I have found Outbeat Radio News, your source for LGBT news from the North Bay and beyond.
This is Greg Maralia with your Outbeat Radio News for the week of July 2nd, 2017. Last weekend, millions gathered for annual LGBT Pride celebrations in New York, Chicago, and San Francisco. Police arrested 12 protesters in New York who tried unsuccessfully to stop the parade. In San Francisco, over 250 contingents marched down Market Street during the 7-hour parade. The parade started with the usual dykes on bikes, but this year a number of resist and anti-police contingents followed as a reminder that the struggle for LGBT civil rights continues. San Francisco's Pride celebration concluded without incident. Police were very present at the parade, at the festival, and in the Castro throughout the weekend. I was there and have to say the officers all looked very professional, were friendly, and made me feel safe. So thank you, SFPD, from all of us. But things didn't go as smoothly in Istanbul, Turkey, where police stopped LGBT activists from gathering in large numbers for the LGBT Pride Parade on the very same weekend. Organizers of the 2017 Istanbul LGBT Pride had vowed to march in central Taksim Square using the Turkish hashtag for We March, despite the ban on gay pride observances ordered by the Istanbul governor's office for the third year in a row. Police established checkpoints in the area, preventing groups from entering Istiklal Avenue and turning back individuals who were deemed to be associated with the planned march. Small groups assembled on side streets and were chased away by officers. At least 100 protesters gathered in a nearby neighborhood, beating drums and chanting slogans such as, "Don't be quiet, shout out, gays exist." They carried a banner that read, "Get used to it, we're here." Police used tear gas to disperse the crowds, and activists said plastic bullets were also used. Turkey's official news agency said an estimated 20 people were detained after protesters did not heed warnings to disperse because the march did not have a permit. And here in the U.S., the Supreme Court is taking on a new clash between gay rights and religion in a case about a wedding cake for a same-sex couple from Colorado. The justices announced they will consider whether a baker who objects to same-sex marriage on religious grounds can refuse to make a wedding cake for a gay couple. The case takes on the High Court to balance the religious rights of the baker against the couple's right to equal treatment under the law. Similar disputes have popped up across the United States. The decision to take the case reflects renewed energy among the court's conservative justices, whose ranks have recently been bolstered by the addition of Justice Neil Gorsuch to the High Court. The court will review a Colorado court decision that found baker Jack Phillips and his Masterpiece Cake Shop discriminated against a gay couple under Colorado state law. Phillips told the Supreme Court he has free speech and religious rights under the First Amendment that should protect him. He said he should not be compelled to bake a cake specifically to honor a same-sex marriage. Colorado's anti-discrimination law protects people on the basis of sexual orientation. Jennifer Pfizer from Lambda Legal said, "Courts that have considered the arguments pressed by the baker in this case consistently have come to the same conclusion. The Constitution does not give anyone the right to harm others based on a religious belief." She added, "These basic principles have been settled for decades, and we hope the Supreme Court will reaffirm them without creating anti-LGBT exceptions." And speaking of the Supreme Court, last Monday marked the 2-year anniversary of the landmark marriage case that opened the door nationwide for same-sex couples to marry. UCLA's Williams Institute reported this week that there are now 547,000 married same-sex couples in the United States. Since the U.S. Supreme Court's Obergefell decision in June of 2015, approximately 157,000 same-sex couples have gotten married here in the United States. For a calendar of LGBT news and events happening here in the North Bay, go to gaysonoma.com. And for all the latest LGBT news headlines we're following, go to our website at outbeatnews.com. For KRCB's Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moralia.
Outbeat Radio News, your source for LGBT news from the North Bay and beyond.
And if you just joined us, this is Living Proof with Diana and Sheridan, and we're in studio this evening with Mandy, the first trans correctional officer at San Quentin. And hello, Mandy.
Hello.
That's a long, big statement. That says a lot. Trans correctional.
I wish I had a shorter title.
I know. Yeah. That, I mean, think about it, though. I mean, it makes you think about a lot of different components of that.
Yes.
So we want you. I wanted to mention earlier that I also saw you again at the rally that we had here, Pride Rally, before Guernville's Pride Day.
Yes. The Rise Up.
Yeah. The rally. Rise Up. Yeah. That was beautiful. And you spoke there.
Yes.
And you said some wonderful things. So, so let's just start from the beginning. So when did you, how long you've been working at San Quentin? And give us a little history about that.
I arrived in San Quentin in December of 2007. So it's been nearly 10 years. Mm-hmm. Although if you count from the day I started the academy, 10 years will be this August. So.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so when did you, how long have you been trans that you knew about before changing your wardrobe at work? No, you haven't changed the wardrobe. I know that.
Well, the wardrobe is kind of stayed the same. It's still a uniform.
Yes.
Yeah, a lot of trans people get asked, when did they first know they were different? Or when did you know you were a girl? Mm-hmm. I always tell people I didn't know I was a girl, but I also didn't know I was a boy. I was just me. It started back in kindergarten when I had my best friend, and her name was Maritza. And Maritza and I, like, loved each other, hung out all the time, held hands on the playground, and went around and made dirt cakes and whatever else you do when you're 5 years old. And that relationship was eventually stopped because of the perception that it was somehow sexual, right, at 5 years old.
And so how did they come to that? What were you
basically
doing?
Basically they just told me that, you know, I'm a boy, she's a girl, and the amount of time we were spending together was inappropriate. And this is when I found out, not that I was a girl, but that I was a boy. It didn't even occur to me before that. And that's when I started to notice the differences between gender, the differences between the way people dressed, the way people treated boys and girls, and the very masculine toys that I got as a child versus what my sister got, you know, the differences in our genitalia. I always say that I never saw myself as missing something, but having something extra that didn't belong.
Okay, say that again.
I never really saw myself as is missing or like, you know, I never saw myself as missing anything, but having an extra appendage that just wasn't there. So
you felt like you were, I don't know if you had your different name or as far as being a girl, a boy.
Yeah,
a boy.
Well, I quickly came to associate myself with being a girl. I used to pray, sit at my bedside every night and pray to God. I was raised Roman Catholic, and I used to sit and pray and ask God to make me normal. And to me, normal wasn't to make me a boy. It was to make me a girl like other girls. Mm-hmm. I never asked to be made a boy. Mm-hmm. Never. Mm-hmm. I never even really looked for those options, especially as a child. And afterwards, I came to the conclusion that God wasn't listening to me. So I looked into other avenues. I looked into magic. And so I tried learning magic tricks as if somehow that would eventually lead to me finding the secret to changing my gender. I wrote a piece on Huffington Post about this, but I even had this little fantasy that I used to make up stories about being an alien princess. And, you know, so I went through all the little coping mechanisms that children who are suffering, children who are abused, you know, and in a way, growing up transgender is abuse. Not because being trans is being abused, but being forced to live as something that you're not is abuse. And I would say that's the same for anyone who's queer, whether trans, gay, or otherwise.
Yeah, I'm glad that you're bringing light to that abuse word. Mm-hmm. Because, it's trapping you into something that you're not and making you, forcing you to be something that you're not.
And I would say it's a weird sort of abuse because it's not necessarily perpetrated against you on purpose. You know, unless you tell somebody how you're feeling, it's hard for people to know. You know, they just make assumptions about you and who you are and what you're going to be. You know, if you're a young lesbian woman growing up, before you come out, you keep getting asked, you know, when are you going to meet the right man? You know, oh, he's handsome, look at him, or I met this sweet guy that you love. And the same thing for me being trans growing up is, you know, my family, my parents planning my life for me, meeting a good girl and having lots of grandbabies, you know. That's their most important thing. They want grandchildren. But they do have plenty of grandchildren, just not for me. Mm-hmm.
But did they ever tell you, don't be a girl, don't do this, don't do that when you're playing with your little friend,
Marissa? They never really encouraged or did. I would say they never really encouraged or discouraged me from playing with one toy or another. I watched Rainbow Bright along with my sister, and I kind of disguised my feminine play as being capitulating to my sister, like, you know, being friendly to my sister, being a good brother. You know, I'm going to play with her dolls because she's playing with the dolls. But I would have never played with them on my own because that, to me, would have kind of outed me, even though would not have at that age, you know. But
so you tried all these different techniques, mm-hmm. the magic and the fantasy and the daydreaming and all of that stuff. And so
praying.
And
I include the magic and the fantasy as I include in that is praying, mm-hmm. you know, for me. Mm-hmm.
And so you're five. So just move us along a little bit. And then we'll keep poking at you for questions and, you know, trying to get some more clarity about your childhood and as you moved forward.
Well, what happened to me is I used to play dress up in my mother's clothes. Also something that I've written about before in my blog. I used to put on my mother's blue dress. I called it my magical blue dress because whenever I put it on, I could become whatever I wanted. And I wasn't just a girl. I was a princess. I was a ballerina. I was a space pirate. I love sci-fi, but
space pirate.
You know, I was a space pirate in a blue dress. Mm. You know, I played all these interesting fantasies, but I was always a girl in each one of them. But I had different roles as a woman. I didn't see being a woman as being limited to anything. Like, I wasn't limited to being a housewife or a cook or a secretary, all this very stereotypical things that women are told they're supposed to be when they grow up. You know, I never pretended to be a doctor, but maybe I just never saw myself as a doctor. Maybe an evil doctor.
Oh.
Yeah.
What's with the evil?
I don't know. It has an attraction to it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And, you know, so I used to play all these games and eventually got to the point to where dressing up just wasn't helping anymore. It wasn't working to kind of ease my depression. And so I ended up throwing it away for a little while until I hit puberty. And then what happened in puberty for me is what happens to boys when they go through puberty is they get the wet dreams, right? Mm-hmm. And mine did not, my dreams from that point on never included me as a boy. I was never a boy in my dreams, and it confused me very, very much. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't know what to make of it, and I'd kind of disconnected from the childhood that I had as a little girl trying to find herself. So it, when I hit puberty, I had kind of, everything came back and I became even more depressed. And this is around the age of 14 when I went into high school. You know, I got beat up a lot as a kid because they thought I was gay. I got jumped by 14 kids.
14 at one time?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
As they screamed homophobic slurs and everything else at me. You know, it never occurred to them that I was also trans, but this is the 90s, early 90s. Mm-hmm. So I entered high school in 94. So, and at that point, you know, coming out as trans wasn't on anybody's radar, but being gay was. And that's how I was being perceived, and that's what they bullied me for.
Did you ever talk to teachers? Did they have any teachers like with the triangle or any kind of support there?
No, that did not exist. Oh. There was
94?
94, no. There was no gay straight alliance of any kind in high schools or even college when I went to college. I think most of that's a product of, if anything, the late 90s and early 2000s. It may have existed in some places.
In places, yeah.
You know, it may have started in the early 90s in a particular area, just not my area, you know. So, so what ended up happening to me is I had to deal with all of this. I had to deal with going through puberty. And what happens to a boy when they go through puberty? Their voice drops. You start growing facial hair. Your body gets taller and bigger. And this is happening to me. And it felt like a betrayal of my own body. My body was killing me. Mm. It was out to get me. And it was ensuring that I would never be able to live a happy life as myself, right? Mm. And that ended in me attempting suicide, my first attempt, just before the end of high school. And shortly after that, I went to college for a little bit. Did not work out. And then right after that, I kind of just one day drove by the recruiter's office and joined the Navy. Mm. I didn't even ask. Mm-hmm. You know.
So can we just go back a little bit with the attempt of suicide? So you're here. I mean, it was an attempt. So what happened? Who found you or how did you get help?
Yeah. Well, my method of choice for myself at that point was pills. I don't even know what I took. I just know I passed out and started throwing up. And a friend of mine took me to the ER and just told them I had been drinking, which I was drunk at the time. So they just kind of gave me electrolytes and, you know, made sure that I was okay and sent me home. I was already 19 years old, mm-hmm. so I didn't have to report to a family member or anything, you know, at that point. Mm-hmm. So nobody ever found out. It wasn't until years later that my mother found out when I wrote about it. Uh-huh. I don't think I even told her before I had written about it. She just read about it. Mm-hmm. And it's not something that I like to revisit or talk about too much, mm-hmm. just because I don't think, you know, it's important to mention, but it's not important to mm-hmm. relive every time you tell it to somebody. Mm-hmm. Because what's important is not how you almost tried to hurt yourself. It's how you got through it.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, exactly. And the reason why I wanted to know more is just mm-hmm. just for information and for people listening. You know, I hear what you're saying, but I'm just saying just for people listening who might be in that position.
Exactly.
And so how do you move through that? So you say you're on your way to college, and so.
As a college student, I've been considered fiercely intelligent by a lot of people. I would go to all my classes only on days where there were tests. I would walk in, take the test, pass, and go home. I wouldn't show up for classes. I thought it was amazing that nobody cared that I was in class. They didn't call my home. No, nobody cared. And then I get my grades, F, 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 all straight Fs. I passed every test with an A. But because of my attendance, they literally failed me in every class. So my second semester was literally taking all the same classes again. And I got straight A's, and I slept every day in class.
Oh, my.
I slept through all the classes because, and I still passed. But as long as I was physically there, that's all that mattered. And they didn't care that I was able to pass their test without even being in class. You know? And I realized that I wasn't mature enough yet to go to college, or at least not, I wasn't a complete person, right? Because I was still fighting this battle and still trying to find out who I was. I took a bunch of psychology classes. I saw a panel of LGBT people for the first time. It was the first time I literally in my life interacted with anyone who was openly gay or trans. You know, I spent my whole life growing up avoiding people like that for me because I felt that, if I hang around them, that people are going to assume, you know, and I didn't want to be outed. And that's a situation that a lot of young LGBT people in the closet find themselves in, is they don't want to associate with the community before they come out, you know, because there's that sense of fear that people will recognize what you are. Strangely enough, the transgender person who came to our college class, our sexual psychology class, she, after I asked her a bunch of questions, she asked me asked me if I was trans.
You mean in front of everyone?
No, privately, but so she saw that I was searching. I was a little too curious, you know, about everything. And then I kind of left that arena and drove home one day past the recruiter's office and walked in and signed a bunch of paperwork. They didn't even have to sell. They didn't even have to do the sales pitch. I just walked in and said, "I want to join," and I did. And I came home, told my parents I'm joining the Navy, or I've already joined, and they were trying to figure out ways to get me out of it.
Oh, really?
They didn't want me to go.
Oh, really? And your desire? I mean, after talking with the trans person, what made you want to go to the military?
I felt I needed a change of venue. That the life I was living in that area, around family, around friends, and that had I attempted to do anything there, it would have just been, you know, it would have been inconceivable. And going into the military was my last effort to try to rid myself of any illusion that I would ever transition. You know, it was my last bastion of hope for, at that point, you know, for lack of a better term, being like everybody else, being normal or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And how long did you stay?
I did 4 years active duty service in Yokosuka, Japan, and 4 years as an inactive reserve. And my job in the Navy was what they call a damage control man, which is a firefighter. And the majority of my job was teaching. I taught people firefighting. I was the ship's CBRD expert, which is chemical, biological, radiological defense. So I dealt with a lot of serious stuff. And, you know, and we did a lot of interesting things. And I joined in 1999, you know, not long before 9/11 and the fall of the Twin Towers. And that kind of changed what it was like to be in the military at that point, because I joined during peacetime. And then all of a sudden we were at war. And I even remember being on a ship and watching W on board the aircraft carrier saying mission accomplished. And yet we were still there for like 10 more years.
Wow.
Yeah, I just had a quick question.
Sure.
I want to go back to the trans person that came and talked to you at your college class.
Mm-hmm.
And you asked a bunch of questions, and so she asked you if you were trans.
Yeah.
I was curious, what you said, and was that the first time anyone had ever asked you that?
It was definitely the first time anybody ever asked me, and I denied.
Ah.
I wasn't ready to admit it.
Mm-hmm.
College was the first time I ever even heard the term trans or transgender or transsexual. Before, it was tranny or transvestite. It was like porn terminology, she-male, he-she, whatever. And the girls on Jerry Springer, where they get up and the audience has to guess which one's a boy, which one's a girl. Those were, for lack of a better term, my role models growing up. That's who society was telling me, that's what society was telling me that I was. Some kind of sideshow attraction, a freak, something for people to laugh at, something for the hero of a movie to discover about his love interest. Oh my God, she has a penis, she's a man or whatever. And I didn't want to be a part of that. I didn't want to admit that that's what my future held for me, you know. And so going in the Navy is very... considered to be, military is considered to be very macho, and being a firefighter, very macho. They're always, and it was mostly true, the firefighters on board ships are some of the biggest guys on the ship. They're very, usually very muscular, very large, because we have to live, we lift a lot of heavy equipment. And we have to be able to grab a 4-inch hose that's going wild and wrangle it.
mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you've ever seen a 4-inch hose. They're huge. Mm. And they're not easy to handle when they're turned on. 250 PSI.
Wow.
It's a lot of water moving through a gigantic hose. And we have different size hoses on the ships, but anyway, I don't want to get too much into it.
So on the ship, so you finished the military.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious about during that time, what happened to that part of yourself? Were you able to just shut it down? Or
no, I tried and it did not work. I think I lasted, once I got to the ship, I probably lasted a few months before I started seeking out places to dress up and be myself. And whenever I speak to in front of groups of people, I always joke that finding women's clothing for me in Japan is almost impossible. I'm 6 foot. I have a 24-inch shoulder span, like wider than most men out there, which makes finding women's clothing in general very difficult. And in Japan, it was nearly impossible. I managed to do it.
Mm.
And I remember it was the first time I had gone into a store to actually buy a bra and some outfits. And I spoke very little Japanese at that time. And the lady at the store, she could see what I was trying to do. She saw through me, and she just muttered something in Japanese and grabbed a tape measure, put it around my midsection,
uh-huh.
Grabbed the bra off a rack and shoved me into the dressing room.
Oh,
and I was like,
yes.
Yeah, I was like, okay. I was definitely one of those trans women who would walk into a women's store and go, yeah, I'm shopping for my girlfriend. And they go, oh, that's nice. Is she about your size? And we're like, yeah, how'd you know?
All the codes.
Yeah, she's about my size. Well, let's get you measured and we'll find out what'll fit her.
Wow.
And they're like, you want to try these on in the dressing room? You're like, fine, at this point, let's do it, you know. Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's some good people out there, huh?
Yeah, there are.
So cool.
Should
we have Mandy do the... talk about the song, and then we'll move into San Quentin.
Sure.
And how life is there for you.
Yeah.
Well, okay, will you tell about the song that you chose?
The song I chose for today was Beautiful by Christina Aguilera, which I wanted to pick something else because I felt like it was maybe cliche, but at the same time, it's a song about recognizing the beauty in everybody, no matter what they look like, sound like, eat like, play like, whatever. If you're able to actually watch her music video that accompanies it, it really sends that home. And it's just a message, and like it'll say in the song, everybody's beautiful, no matter what they say.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
Yeah.
every day is so wonderful, and suddenly it's hard to breathe. Now and then I get insecure from all the pain. I'm so ashamed.
Was Christina Aguilera singing her song Beautiful, and we were watching the video as well on YouTube. Boy, I would highly suggest everybody to click on that. It's what year is that? 2009 or 2007, something. I mean, that was 91 million views.
Yeah,
it's very powerful and very relevant to tonight's discussion. We are in studio with Mandy Camille Howard, and we're talking about Mandy's childhood, and I think we're going to be moving into more of her adulthood and her job at San Quentin, and we just want to welcome you back, and thank you so much for being here.
It's my pleasure.
Yeah, that was really a powerful segment of the song, and especially like Cher said, like what we're talking about,
you know,
and relevant and very current, and I'm just trying to breathe through that. Yeah. You know what I mean?
So, I always forget how triggering it is, the video especially, and you know, I think it'll be hard to talk about things from moving forward.
I know. Yeah.
After that.
Yeah. I know. Yeah. So we're gonna. I had to take a breath and then refocus, and because it's important. It's just sad that we have to struggle, and hearing your struggle, you know, that, and that you're continuing to struggle as you are working at San Quentin.
Exactly.
And so talk about how is it to, we're going to jump because, you know.
Yeah.
Time flies when you're, you know, talking deep like this. So, so why don't you just go ahead and get us started with how it was for you the day that you decided to come out at San Quentin?
Well, the actual process of coming out at San Quentin happened over the course of several months. I had gotten to be extremely suicidal again and calling in sick to work constantly. And I think, I want to say in 2011 or 2010, I probably missed an equivalent of about 6 months worth of work. I had at the time FMLA, so I was protected, and I'm glad I had it. And the only thing I had at home to bring me back were the two pugs that I had. I had two little pugs that I was taking care of, so they kind of helped out. But then I got to the point to where I said that I'm going to either have to transition at San Quentin while working at San Quentin, and or leave, and or end my life. Those are my options, at least to me at that time. Obviously, I probably had many more options, but when you're singular and you're focused, you know, it's, you don't see any other way out. And so I decided to start pushing the boundaries by wearing makeup at work. Little eyeshadow or mascara or eyeliner. People just assumed I was goth, which is fine, but eventually it got to the point to where people noticed, and they pulled me into an office and asked me about it, and I told them for the first time, I think almost ever. I had already come out to my parents before this, but you know, I told them I was transgender, and their immediate response was that cross-dressing was not allowed. And then I spent the next half hour or so, or hour, I can't remember now, but educating them on what it was to be trans and the differences between being a cross-dresser, being transvestite or transgender, or even just gay and queer in general. And it was interesting, and it wasn't until a couple months later that I eventually got to walk on grounds openly as a transgender woman. I don't know the date off the top of my head, but I do have paper and documentation. So the date is set in stone. I have it somewhere, but I don't have it remembered off the top of my head. I should remember it. It'd be nice to give people the exact date. But I believe it was in 2012 in July, I believe. So actually...
Freedom.
Oh, yeah.
Month. Yes.
And it was a very... interesting experience, because I got up in the morning and I did not want to go. And I knew I had today was the day that I was going to go. And I almost decided not to do it. And I was just going to go to work as I had before. But then, you know, I put on my makeup. And at this time, the way I was doing my makeup was more like a geisha girl. I put on a liquid foundation, powder, every piece of makeup I could find that you could put on your face, I was putting it on. You know, contouring and everything. I was trying everything. And I literally had to put my makeup on and off probably three times before I decided it was good enough to go to work. And then I went and actually took a pic. I have pictures of that day. I took pictures with my cell phone, which, by the way, you're not allowed to take your cell phone in the prison, but I did take mine to take pictures. And it was interesting because I had a lot, my hair was a lot shorter. I didn't yet have the female tie. It was just me in the same uniform that I've always been wearing, just with makeup and the acknowledgement that I was a female officer by the department. You know, at this point, they were saying, okay, you're a woman, you can come to work as a woman, but you have to adhere to female grooming standards, which I'm assuming means not having a beard, but you're not supposed to have a beard anyway. But I remember they said I couldn't come to work as a girl one day and a boy the next, which is actually not true. The California state law protects gender expression as well as gender identity. And if you know anything at all about the trans community, we have individuals who do not identify as any particular gender. And very often their expression changes. It could change from day to day, even halfway through the day. You know, it just... maybe a more masculine presentation one day and a more feminine the next, and they prefer non-binary pronouns and all that, like they, them, and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And so, but originally I was like, yeah, of course, I'm going to come to work girl every day.
No in more. Your case, that was cool.
Yeah,
that
was it was fine, yeah. It wasn't until like a year later that I decided, you know, I didn't like that anymore, that rule.
Oh, okay.
And I said, you know what, if I wanted to come to work with a mustache, that regardless of how I look, that, you know, like the song we just heard, You're Beautiful No Matter What They Say, that no matter what I look like, I'm still a woman. Mm. Mustache, whatever. I'm 6 foot. I'm still a woman. I've met women way bigger and taller than me. Mm. I've even met women who have bigger shoulder spans. I mean, it's like insane. So every, you know, people come in all different shapes and sizes, and it should not really matter what, as far as your physicality goes. But that was kind of the process of coming out initially. And the response was absolutely horrific from my coworkers. I've got pretty much every response that you can think of from those who just avoided me completely, whispered around corners, those who vocalized their hatred and disgust with what I was doing. And these were my coworkers. And initially, the inmates at San Quentin didn't know what to make of me, but eventually a few of the inmates who had remembered me from before remembered that I was a really nice officer, that I treated them well and with respect. And within a month or so, the inmates, for the most part, started treating me with the respect that I felt I deserved. They gendered me correctly. I've even had, in the past, I've even had inmates correct officers when they misgendered me. Mm. Which is brave. I have to say, if you're an inmate and you're going to correct a CO, that's pretty brave. But and I really do appreciate it, right? Like, people have asked me why I think that is. And one of the reasons I have, I believe, is that inmates know what it's like to be judged for who they are, for the colors they're wearing, the blue or the orange or, you know.
And plus, what you said earlier was that you were kind to them. You respected them. So mm-hmm.
And I somebody once asked me if I've changed as an officer from working as a boy to working as a female. Mm. And my quick answer is no, but I'm not sure. Mm. Like, I've always been, my personality has always been pretty much like it is now. The only difference is I get to be way more open with it, right? I get to express myself without a filter. I get to, if I want to sashay a little bit, I can sashay and nobody can tell me anything. If I want to walk around with my purse, I can walk around with my purse. I don't have to worry about it. You know, I can express myself however I want. I'm not beholden to any idea of femininity or masculinity or just being a human being in general. I'm my own thing, you know, I'm my own person.
But it seemed like it would be logical for you to be different because now you're free to express, right? So it would be somewhat different.
Yeah, I definitely think I am different. Like I said, my quick response would have been to say no, but I just don't know. It's hard for me to examine my life before I came out because, it'll make sense to you, maybe it won't, but the further away I get from my coming out, from living as a boy to my beginning of living as a woman openly, that past as a boy is becoming a distant memory to the point where it's hard to access those memories. It's hard to pull them out and analyze them because they're not you. They're somebody else completely different. And people who are not trans tend not to understand that the person they knew was not who you are right now. You like a lot of the same things. I still love nerdy stuff. I still love sci-fi. I love martial arts and, you know, all the things that I did growing up. But my ability to connect myself to that boy is being severed day by day. So when people ask me whether or not I've changed from being a male officer to being female, it's hard for me to say. Mm-hmm. You know, I would like to think I was as nice as I am now. Mm-hmm. But maybe not. You know, there are definitely things I probably did to hide, to kind of be in that closet. Mm-hmm. You know.
Wow.
Are women correctional officers treated differently than men as far as sexism?
I would definitely acknowledge and say that in the corrections and law enforcement in general, women are absolutely treated differently. There's it's a kind of like the idea that you hear about military personnel kind of complaining, the idea about having women on the battlefield, and it's because men in general want to coddle and protect women, right? It's a very misogynistic viewpoint that women need to be protected all the time, and they're much more likely to, if they have to do a cell extraction. I don't know. Do I need to explain what a cell extraction is?
Yeah.
If they have to do a cell extraction.
Pick them out. Pull them out.
Yeah. They're more likely to pick men than any females that are on duty at that point. And women are expected to not to have pretty accoutrement. You know, their pretty nails, nice makeup. And to me, especially when I started transitioning, I kind of felt like, and I haven't really talked to other women at work about this, and maybe they don't analyze it as much as I do. Maybe they do, maybe more. But to me, it's almost like a form of Sharia, you know, if I want to put a term to it. It's a form of blaming women for being too attractive to men, and men, in other words, the more you put on, the more these men are going to be unable to control themselves. And I have been sexually assaulted by an inmate as well at San Quentin. So I definitely have sadly experienced the full gamut of what it's like to be a woman working inside a prison. But I also think I also get treated very differently from the other women in the prison because I am trans. So I'm not, I would never say that my experience is identical to theirs or the same, but it is very similar. You know, and I definitely started to get treated differently after I transitioned.
Okay, so how are you, I mean, as far as supported, I mean, I know the your coworkers are not so kind.
No.
So is there a supervisor or something? I mean, is there some protocol?
I will say this, over the last, it's been 5 years since I came out, just about. There are plenty of people right now at work, coworkers, who are very nice and very kind to me. Most of them are new cops. They're people who just came in. They never knew me before. And that definitely probably helps them to see me as a female officer. But the problem is I know for a fact, and I just was told this by a coworker recently, that when he was in the academy, that people were warning him about me to not to talk to me, not to associate with me, because he'll be... you know, people shun him, or I'll get offended if he goes, "Oh man, I'm tired." I'll go, "Did you say man? Write you up." You know, they think I'm that sensitive. I'm like, "Oh, we're going to prison." I'm not that sensitive. I am sensitive, but I'm not that sensitive. And that people at the prison are warning other people, other newer officers, not to associate with me, not to talk to me, to be careful of, "Oh, don't say man," or "don't say sir" or "him" around, you know. And in those conversations, they gender me as male as well. So especially when I'm not around, they, you know, nobody seems to care. And it just kind of frustrates me to know that that's happening. Even if it's not happening to me directly, I can feel it. I can feel the energy when I walk into a room. Right, you can feel when people are uncomfortable with you. You know, the two of you are married, and when you go out holding hands, or you're out and you just give a little peck on the cheek or something, you can tell when people are like, you know, they're very uncomfortable with what you've just done, or just the fact that you're even near each other. You know, and they don't have to say nothing. They don't even have to make a noise. They just, you can just tell. And that's every day for me walking around the institution. Now, like I said before, there are a growing number of officers who are very supportive of me, and supervisors and whatnot. And I'm very happy and proud that they're there, and that some of them are even starting to stick up for me. And that's great. And hopefully that means there's a turning point, a change coming. Hopefully I'll be around to see it, you know.
What do you mean, hopefully you'll be around to see it? You planning to leave, or?
Yeah. My goal right now is one of a couple things. I don't think I'm going to be leaving anytime soon. By that, I don't mean this year, next year, probably a few more years. But I am working my way out. Right now, I'm reporting for Gay Sonoma, and I'm doing my blog, and I'm writing, working on a couple of books. Mm. And, you know, I'm moving into the space of being a writer and maybe even a journalist or whatnot. But I'm still just trying to find my niche. And I've been told again and again that I'm a good writer, so I figure I might as well pursue that. You know, it seems like something that I'm passionate about and that I'm good at.
I'd like to ask you about your blog.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you anyway. So could you tell us a little bit about it and then how people can look you up?
Yeah. If you just type in my name, Mandy Howard, in Huffington Post, it'll usually have a link to my author's page. And all the articles I've written up to now are on there, at least the ones I published on there are on there. And if you scroll all the way down to the bottom, that's the first story I've written. So the top stories are the newest and all that. I literally have not written anything in 7 months because I have had a bad case of writer's block. And I was writing consistently for a couple of years, and then I just stopped. And I don't know why. And I'm writing other things, just not my blog. But the original story that I'd written on there, I had shared with some people on Facebook and Instagram, and somebody commented that, oh, this belongs on HuffPost, Queer Voices, Gay Voices at the time. And I'm like, I know people from Huffington Post because they interviewed me. I was on HuffPost Live, and they interviewed me on camera for their show. And so I reached out to the producers that I knew, and they put me in contact with the editor for Queer Voices, Gay Voices. And I thought they were just going to take my article and publish it. And then instead, they invited me to be a blogger on HuffPost, or part of their blogging community. We're not employees of HuffPost. I don't write for HuffPost. I just blog, and they give me a platform. Mm-hmm. Right? So it's my blog. They own it. I own it. I can republish anywhere I want at any time. Mm-hmm. They don't have exclusivity to mm-hmm. my work. And the original story that I put on there was me writing a letter to my parents. And it was almost a sort of a poetic format, not a poetic in its phrasing, but the format was like three lines, three lines, three mm-hmm. lines, or each paragraph is three lines. And it was just me going through my history, being born, being their little boy, being a gymnast, a martial artist, and going in the Navy, but all the time acknowledging how they saw me, and then turning that around to my transition and how they dealt with it or didn't deal with it, you know, the negativity they had at the beginning. And it just kind of takes people through my whole journey up until San Quentin, but from the perspective of acknowledging the journey that my parents went on. And acknowledging the pain of losing their son. And regardless of how I feel about it, they lost their son. Right? That's not how I feel, but that's how they feel. And that's fine. A lot of trans people want their parents to not feel that way. You can't feel that way. It's insensitive. It's, you know, you don't acknowledge me then if you feel that way. But I am a believer in that you need to let people feel how they feel so long as they come to the right place. Mm-hmm. So long as they arrive at the right place, that's all that matters. It doesn't matter the journey they took to get there. Mm-hmm. My journey to get to where I'm at is different from everybody else. Mm-hmm. And there's no wrong or right way to get there. And I'm extremely fortunate that in 2015, I had my gender reassignment surgery and my parents were there.
Wow,
my mother, my father, my sister, we stayed at the hotel the night before. I drank all the horrible fluid they make you drink, the cleansing fluid. Mm-hmm. And they were with me at the hospital when I went into surgery, and they were there when I woke up. And my sister bought me a teddy bear that's meant to draw on for kids. And you draw on it, and you can wash it, and they could draw again. But she bought permanent markers. And so everybody who came to see me, came to visit me, signed my bear. So now I have a tattooed bear, but it's very awesome because it's better than a card, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Because now I can have it if I want to. I can snuggle with it, you know. And it was amazing, and I'm very, very fortunate to have that. Mm-hmm.
Wow, thank you for telling us that piece about your parents and family supporting you, coming to their journey. Allowing them to do their work.
Exactly.
To get to where they need to be.
Because when you come out, when you transition, your family's coming out. Your family's transitioning. They're right alongside on that journey with you. Because at the end of the day, I think even the parents who disown and say hurtful things to their children, I think at the end of the day, they still love their children. Sadly, some of them may never come around. And that's unfortunate. And that's why I say I'm very, very fortunate to have my parents come around.
Wow. Well, thank you, Mandy. I mean, you're so courageous. I just have to say you're so courageous to walk into San Quentin every day and be yourself.
Yeah. Thank you.
So this is the time of our show that we like to have our guests offer some wisdom or some advice. And I think you've been doing that, but maybe you can encapsulate it in such a way that it's that wisdom or advice, suggestions to the audience or somebody else who might be dealing with this.
Well, I'll kind of wrap the advice in the dealings that I've had with other transgender individuals, especially in that they see other people around them who are transitioning, right? They look at other individuals and they go, wow, I wish I was where you were at. Like, I'm 37. I know a few 25-year-olds and 27-year-olds who feel like they're just not transitioning fast enough. And they look at me and I've already had these surgeries. I've already had all this other stuff. But I go, but at your age, I wasn't even out, right? So the advice I would have to give would just be to say that everybody has their own journey to go on, and wherever you're at, that's the right place to be at that moment. And that so long as you keep putting another foot forward, you're going to get there. Mm. And that's the best advice I can give, is just keep putting another foot forward, even if it takes a long time, that you'll eventually get where you need to be.
Mm. That's great advice. I mean, that could be true for anybody. Yeah. I like that. As long as you step forward, you're going to get to where you need to go.
Mm-hmm.
I like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I really do believe that. And doing the writing and doing the blogs is putting my feet forward. Mm-hmm. So.
Yes, keep on writing, keep on writing, keep on telling your story. Thank you, Mandy, so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much, Mandy.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome. I just want, we just want everyone to know that, like Mandy, you too can be living proof that through sharing your story, you can support others in being free and living life authentically. It's another way to help the world. And like Mandy, you too can be visible and vibrant in telling your story. This is Diana and Sheridan, and we'll be back next month. Until then,
good night.
Registration is underway now at Napa Valley College and Santa Rosa Junior College for LGBT studies classes with start dates this August. If you're interested in LGBT literature, sign up for English 36 at Santa Rosa JC. This class meets on Monday night starting August 21st, and you can register right now at santarosa.edu. And the Introductions to LGBT Studies class at Napa Valley College also meets on Monday nights this fall starting August 14th. Registration's open for LGBT 120 at napavalley.edu. You're listening to KRCB Radio 91. That's 91.1 KRCB FM Windsor and 90.9 K215 CQ Santa Rosa. It's just before 9 p.m. Stay with us. Open Space District is next.